Hey everyone, this is Ben Morton and thanks for joining me on another episode of the show. And what an episode it is. I'm absolutely delighted to bring you this episode and my interview with Edwina Dunn, OBE. Edwina is one of the most successful leaders in the data industry with a career of delivering transformational business change. She founded Dunnhumby with her husband in 1989, a company that revolutionized the world of retail and consumer goods when they pioneered the Tesco Club Card and other global loyalty programs. Edwina is also the former chairman at StarCount, a consumer insights and digital consultancy. More recently, though, she founded The Female Lead, a foundation celebrating the achievements and diversity of women, also donating 18,000 copies of the book, The Female Lead, Women Who Shape Our World, to schools and universities across the UK and USA. In 2019, Edwina received an OBE for her services to data and business in the UK, and is also on the boards of both the Centre for Data Ethics and Innovation and the Geospatial Commission. In this episode, Edwina shares her experience and the challenges of working in a male-dominated industry and some of her thoughts on how to overcome those. She also speaks about how you maintain the essence and culture of a business as it scales rapidly around the globe and much, much more. But very briefly before we get into it, I also have some exciting news for you in that we've just launched a brand new online program designed to help leaders and managers to really play at their best in and out of work in a fast-paced, rapidly changing world that we all find ourselves living and working in. All of the details for that are in the show notes, along with an exclusive 30% discount code for you as a fan of the podcast. But that's enough about that for now. So please, without any further delay, here is my interview with Edwina Dunn, OBE. Edwina, hello and a huge warm welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm very well, Ben. Thank you.
Great. So Edwina, I know from the little bit of research that I've done that you have got several roles at the minute, and work-wise, at least you're wearing several hats. So for those of you who perhaps don't know you and haven't done the internet research that I've done, can you just tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is that you are up to these days?
Well, right now, I'm still involved in data science. After Dunnhumby, I moved on to StarCount, which is a kind of new era data science. And we've been working on innovations there. And recently, I'm very proud to say my daughter took over the business, which is very exciting, allowing me more time for my other roles, although I am still involved from time to time in the business. So my other roles are, I lead The Female Lead, which is my charity all about telling fantastic stories of women and sharing that across the world. And then I also sit on two government boards, the CDEI, the Centre for Data Ethics and Innovation, and the Geospatial Commission, where I'm a commissioner.
Wow, incredible. And you mentioned Dunnhumby there as well. Can you just give us a little bit, if you will, of the backstory or the journey, Edwina, that got you to where you are now? What does that look like?
Well, I will give you the short version.
That's perfect.
It's a business. So my original, I suppose, grounding in the whole area of how to use data was in the area actually of geospatial. It was all around small area statistics and then linking that to a way of describing people. It was the early stages of things like Acorn and Mosaic, which then became the backbone of industries like credit scoring and risk scoring and insurance and things like that. So that's where I learned my trade and where I also met my husband, Clive Humby. And we then, years later, after having married, we started our own business, Dunnhumby. And we started using customer transaction data rather than small area statistics. It was all about you are what you buy. So 5 years in, Tesco found us and were interested in this idea of loyalty engagement. So began Tesco Clubcard. And we just happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right tech and the right approach. And we were, you know, very fortunate to be part of that huge journey and that big launch of Clubcard way back in 1995. And at the time, Tesco were number two way back in the market, and Clubcard and all the work around knowing customers propelled them to the number one position, double their market share in less than 3 years. So it was a phenomenal era, and we learned so much, and the business grew, and we took it all over the world. In the end, we were, you know, 1,500 people in 25 different countries, and yeah, it was brilliant.
Wow. And Edwina, you mentioned just now when you was talking about the start and origins of Dunnhumby, you said you were fortunate, I think, to be in the right place and the right time. Now, regular listeners of the show might start smiling now because this is becoming a real pet project of mine, and actually an area I'm starting to do a lot of research in, which is essentially luck in business. Because so many people who come on the show, so many of the MDs and CEOs say things like, oh, we were just lucky, I was just lucky, we were really fortunate. And I've always had this phrase, and I'm not sure where I got it from, that there's no such thing as luck. It's just timing and judgment. Now, I don't 100% believe that, because I do believe there is just an element of luck or maybe some sort of higher intelligence in the universe. And whilst you use the word fortunate and not luck, do you believe you generally were fortunate or lucky? Or do you believe as leaders, as businesses, as individuals, we create our own luck? What's your view and take on that?
It's a really interesting question. And I think for me, timing is really important. You can do exactly the right thing. You can have the right conversation. If it's not the right time, it won't land. We happen to have a skill that Tesco needed at a moment in time. They tried everything else. They were a really mature business. They'd gone through a whole heap of efficiency drivers. They created some really smart customer orientated initiatives, but they needed something extra. And I think that combination of them arriving at a point in time where they tried everything and, you know, how are we going to break through? And we happen to be, you know, pioneering a new approach. I think that timing is important. It was also the time when technology was just taking off. I mean, many of your listeners won't remember this time, but, you know, we had to bring our first computer in through High Holborn office window because it was so big. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's smaller. It's smaller than a handheld Apple now, and less powerful. But at the time, it was one of the few commercial computers in operation. So technology was taking off. No one understood data. There was no such thing as data science. So all we had done was learn from people who were looking at, in fact, disease patterns, crop patterns. It's funny how these things all come round, isn't it, with COVID and what have you. But it was the analyst, the data analyst, looking at medical data that had the skills in the area that we were looking for, and financial analysts in the city. So we were kind of caught between both of those. It's a very long answer, but the point is we had the right capability with the right skills at the right time. And then, of course, we had to work very, very hard. But you do need all of that, I think, to have an impact, to really make it to any significant size. You need all those things to be aligned in the same direction.
And did that, I'm just, final question on this, because I'm really curious about the origins and this concept of timing, judgment, and luck in business. Did Dunnhumby sort of evolve because you and your husband Clive were consciously sort of scanning the horizon, looking at what was emerging in terms of new technology, where there might be a gap, and kind of how you could potentially fill that, or was it more chance?
I think in part, yes. It's when you're interested in an area, and we were always interested in this area of data. I mean, at the time, data was not considered either important or strategic. It was kind of quite scientific. And so we wanted to push the boundaries of what you could do with data. And we were using some of the biggest data sets, using this government data that's now owned and published by ONS. To then have customer data was a challenge. And then suddenly to have Tesco transaction data. It's really hard for me to describe to you what a quantum step forward that was in size and complexity. It was huge. You know, every item in every basket, in every store, it was huge. And then we went to America. And of course, it's even bigger. And so every time we did it, we were pushing the boundaries of what computing could manage and, you know, what statistical analysis packages could manage. So it was that alignment of just being able, but we wanted always to press forward with the biggest, hardest, most sophisticated form of analysis. And that's really what gave us the edge at the beginning and kept us with the edge throughout, because we kept pushing the boundary of what could be done.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I'm interested in the particular leadership challenges that then threw up for you. And what were some of the key challenges, and how did you tackle them?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked me that question. It took me a while to figure out that Clive and I had kind of stumbled on a model that was about two people with opposite skills, working together, trusting each other, relying on each other. And although we were married, we were actually the perfect opposites for a business. And so that complementary set of skills made the two of us, I think, bigger and better than we would ever have been alone. And it encouraged me to create this form of leadership, which was contrary to all popular belief that you have one leader, it's lonely, and they make all the decisions. You know, mine was the opposite approach, which was you take two people with opposite skills, put them together, and then give them a really sort of hairy, challenging task. And we literally would take people, because we were such a new high-tech industry and no one had really ever been trained, you know, in this particular application or this style of work ever before. You know, we had to train people, we had to let them practice, be experienced, and then we'd send them all over the world. So we would literally be sending people who were late 20s, early 30s, off to a country where they'd be responsible for a multi-pound, euro, billion-dollar business, which was, you know, the retailer, and then all the consumer product goods manufacturers around that. So they were quite young, very scared, and they stepped forward, the two of them, and I have to say they were just phenomenally successful, you know, suddenly being planted with this enormous amount of responsibility and weight of expectation. They grew and they stepped up. And I remember, you know, the retailers used to, when we'd send them out to start the joint venture that we'd created together, which was the model we had, I would always get a phone call from the CEO, and it would always be, "Why have you sent me children?" And my answer was always the same, which is, "I can send you people who are older, but these people have all had 8 years within the business, and they are the best we have. So if you want someone older, let me know." And, you know, a year after they were there, the CEO would be on the phone saying, we need to keep these two people. They're brilliant. And I was really proud of that.
That's incredible. Again, this is a question that wasn't on the list that I sent you. And so hopefully that's okay. So how did you, I'm really curious how you managed to keep that, I guess culture is the word I'm looking for. How did you manage to keep that culture and real sense of empowerment that I think you described as the business started to grow? So those first people that you sent off around the world working with clients, as they started to need to do the same, how did you ensure that that culture and philosophy that kind of you and Clive had stayed within the business and got passed down? And how did you, I guess, inoculate yourself and the business against that tendency to micromanage and tell people what to do and how to do it, because I've been there and done it myself? Because that's obviously the challenge for many businesses when they grow, isn't it? That how do you maintain that initial culture that you had when the business was small and you knew everybody?
Yeah, it was quite an adjustment. I mean, the main thing was we were growing so fast. I mean, for the first few years, we were growing 100% a year. So, you know, we had to trust people. You know, we worked really hard to recruit bright, highly motivated people. And of course, they had to learn this new skill. So, you know, very fortunately, we were bringing in people who were lifelong learners and who really were not highly numerate, but pretty numerate. Some were very numerate, but they were really storytellers as well as analysts and you know, data scientists. They really had to understand the business they were working in and what was possible to change. Because, I mean, the trouble with data is it can be theoretical. And, you know, we had to make sure people understood what it was like to be that retailer making the decisions on the sharp end. And a lot of the retailers would invite us in and we would second people to them, to the front line, so that they could learn. And I think that really helped. And again, that was one of the advantages of the joint venture model, because, you know, we tried to blend the skills and make them owned by both parties. And talking of parties, the other thing we always did was celebrate very well. And I think, you know, we were a business who became spread all over the world. And there was a danger that everyone would forget that we were one company. And so we used to have a big event every year. Again, not something that people do so much now, but we called it the Skills Development Course. And it was a one day where in each continent, we would celebrate something that we would all come together and learn for the first time. It might be to sing in a choir or to paint a picture or to create a little film, an animation. And we would do that. And it was huge fun. And I think it would remind all of us, and particularly the senior people, that they could be the senior person in the room, but they were probably one of the worst at doing whatever this new challenge was. And that kept us all, I think, grounded and respectful of each other. And I think that was part of the culture.
Yeah, I love that. I just want to pick up on something you mentioned as well then. You talked about recruiting and bringing people into the business who were lifelong learners, which resonated with me. I've just finished reading the book Mindset, which is essentially about growth and fixed mindsets, which I think links to what you was just saying, Edwina. I'm just curious, was that a deliberate strategy? And did you specifically ask people questions about their approach to learning? Or did that happen naturally, just by nature of people who were working in data science at that time?
There weren't really people working in data science. So we hired a lot of geographers, actually, and they made fantastic data scientists, leaders. They brought the element of camaraderie together with the numeracy that you need to a certain extent in geography, but there was teamwork and numeracy. And so we would actually, our interviews were really there to explore whether people had passion and interest in the world around them and in the work that we were doing. And we would always look for people who wanted to know how and why we did what we did. And, you know, we would hire based on their curiosity and their enthusiasm for understanding. And that really was the most fundamental skill that we look for.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. And coming back on track slightly to some of the questions I dropped you ahead of the interview, in your bio that I saw, you talk about knowing what it feels like to work in a male-dominated industry. And I think it says in there, and how a woman's lack of confidence can hold her back. I wonder if there are any lessons you can share that you've learned along the way that would be useful for other women who are aspiring to an MD, CEO role, or any kind of executive position for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the retail industry, especially back then, was almost exclusively male. And you know, I would go into these boardrooms and there were only men at the top table. And, you know, that actually in itself wasn't a problem. It was a surprise. And it was all over the world. So that was probably even more of a surprise. I think a few things I learned, I'm not sure how well I keep to them, but one thing I learned was that if I spoke less, I had a much greater chance of being heard. It's not that I spoke in sections less, but when I said something and made a point, I tried to make that succinct. And also, and I know this because my husband told me, I would often explain things before I gave the recommendation that I was asked for. And I would kind of explain why before I explained what. And he actually encouraged me to say what you think first, and then if asked, explain why. And I thought that was actually quite good advice. I don't know whether it's a male, female thing. You know, you lose track over your life and your career, but it did help quite a lot. So there are a few things like that. But, you know, the world is changing now. And I think there's much more recognition that, you know, women's voices are important, their beliefs are important, their style is important. And I think it's how we help people, you know, really understand what might be, for example, unconscious bias or just invisibility. And those are the things I'm really interested in looking at.
Yeah, and this in some ways is the flip side of the question I've just asked. I wonder as well if you've got any advice or anything you would share perhaps to a very male-dominated board or perhaps a 100% male board who are looking to appoint new MDs, CEOs or executive roles?
Well, simply, I would say you don't know what you're missing. I think if you have a board full of intelligent people, then having another perspective, I think, can be incredibly valuable. And I think you never really know what you're missing until it's in front of you, until it's part of you. And, you know, I would also encourage boards to look at women in more roles than perhaps the ones that are archetypal. I still think a lot of boards of directors think, you know, women aren't that strong and that they might actually burst into tears if put under some stress or strain. And that is just, you know, it's old news and it's apocryphal and it's no longer how the real world works. So I would say, you know, enjoy the change that's coming and make sure that, you know, the women that you pick are the very best, you know, and give everybody on your board a new way of thinking and a new way of reacting.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. And that's probably quite a nice segue into my next question. I know you touched on this a little in the opening, but can you talk to us a little bit, Edwina, about the female lead? So why did you establish the organization, sort of what it exists to do and your vision for it?
Yes, with pleasure. I mean, you know, when I was growing up, I went to a very good school and I had a very forward-thinking headmistress, but my career advice, and it, you know, I'm talking quite a long time ago, but my career advice was you can be a secretary, a teacher, or a nurse. And though that was the advice we were given, and my mother, who I loved, obviously, and admired, was a stay-at-home mother. And so, you know, I didn't really have anything that I had seen that I could mimic. And so my ambition for girls, particularly those who, you know, perhaps have less visibility of what fulfillment or success might look like, you know, and perhaps don't have the entrees into work experience, you know, my ambition is to make it all the more visible. So, you know, the women I share the stories of, you know, it's not just about money and power. It is about this thing we call fulfillment. And I think, you know, fulfillment for women is quite complex. And it really interests me. And a lot of my work moving forward is about breaking down what fulfillment means to each and every one of us. You know, there's this saying, you know, women, can we have it all? And, you know, I think the truth is you don't get all of it at the same time. At different parts in your life, you're stronger on career or perhaps on relationships, perhaps yourself, perhaps what you do for society. And that's really what interests me. So the campaign, the project, is all about women telling stories of when they've been at a peak of fulfillment in each one of these areas. And my hope is that this will help girls growing up to be women and women navigating the world in a way that they can learn from how others have done it, not because any one person is the same as them or has got it right, but because if you tell 60 stories, you know, one of them is going to stand out for you as something that you can relate to and learn from.
Yeah, that's incredible. As you were talking at the end, I was sitting here smiling with a warm feeling in my heart. I've got a 8-year-old daughter who absolutely loves the book Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls.
Super.
And there's probably, I don't know how many short one-page stories there are in that book, probably over 100. So to your point, around for every 60, kind of one will really resonate and people will really connect with them. There's two or three in there that my daughter will just read over and over again. One is Yusra, the Syrian Olympian, who was the first person to compete under a sort of refugee nation state that was created. And she just goes back to that story again and again. So I think you're absolutely right.
Well, that's wonderful. I mean, we have Lucy Bronze in our collection, and she's, you know, I really got a passion for women's football, you know, during their sort of glory passage in the World Cup. And it was very, very exciting. So, yeah, we can all be inspired at any age, really.
Yeah. So the next question in some ways is a selfish one, Edwina, because it's really a question that I'd love to know the answer to. But I'm hoping other listeners will get some value from it as well. So many people listening to the show are probably of an age whereby they have young children. And it's interesting, about 6 weeks ago, I was given a leadership presentation. And at the end, I was asked what my biggest leadership challenge has been in my life. And And I paused and I was going to talk about some stuff in the military. And I said, actually, it's not my, without meaning to sound kind of trite or whatever, my biggest challenge is, and what I put the most effort into, is raising a daughter who's confident to go out into the world, be her own person and be successful. So based on your experience and your work now, what advice, if anyone dares to give advice to other parents, but what advice would you give to parents who want their daughters in particular to grow up being confident kind of women who feel able and empowered to sort of fully compete in the workplace with their male counterparts?
Well, I mean, you know, yes, that is a phenomenally important question, the question for all of us. And frankly, why wouldn't we want girls to be all they can be? Because our sons may grow up and end up with someone, and don't we want her or him to be the best that they can be? So, you know, this is everyone. And before I say what we can do right, if I can just pause and say for a moment, what frightens me at the moment is that our children are spending an enormous amount of time on social media. You know, I've interviewed 14 to 17-year-olds from every walk of life, and they are consuming 6+ hours a day of social media. Now, the thing that worries me is the social media platforms are very, very clever and they use AI. So when we pause on images or content, it very, very quickly learns what we like and it gives us more and more of the same. So what then happens is we become in this sort of ghetto of feeds, and the feeds become more and more the same. So if we're looking at, you know, fashion and celebrity, we see more and more airbrushed models who, you know, have been curated into this image of perfection. And it's a toxic bubble, because girls begin to believe, and they consume it so much more than boys, the girls begin to believe that this is reality and this is how most people in the world look or behave. And it's very, very scary. And we know, because we've measured it, it starts to make them feel really unwell mentally, really insecure and really anxious. And so one of the things we do at the Female Lead is we say, look, we can't stop you using social media because it's all so good, but follow some women that have done amazing things that you might be interested in, who are like your daughter's Israeli Olympian, and, you know, who are going to inspire you and show you that there is a real life and a way that they have actually taken. And that's what we have done, which is we offer teenage girls consuming all this toxic content, and we say, follow 4 other female leads. You can find them all on our website, and everything on our website is free. And you can follow content from all of these women who are, you know, multiple age groups. And at the end of the day, it's going to make you feel better. So your lovely 8-year-old daughter is perhaps not too much in this bubble, but if you can encourage her to follow some interesting, lovely women like she's discovered in her book, then that will keep her feeling positive, where language of ambition and aspiration and belief still exists.
That's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you. Edwina, conscious of your time and being respectful of your time, so I've just got a couple of slightly more quick-fire questions to finish up with. So the first one is, what are the 1 or 2 books that have had the biggest impact upon you?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I read to escape, and I read so much. I really can't pull one down. I would say The Female Lead has changed my life, and I'm sorry to be so selfish. But other than that, everything I read is the stories of people or the stories of life, and that is what refreshes me and reinvigorates me. And I really couldn't point to one.
Okay, not a problem at all. We'll stick the a link to the female lead in the show notes for everybody. And are there any particular ways of working, routines that you use that are particularly helpful? People are always interested in the top tips and productivity hacks and ways of working of senior leaders. Is there anything like that you can share?
Well, the only thing I have found particularly useful is silence every now and again. I think we are a world that plugs in all the time. If we're not watching a movie or talking to friends, we're listening to podcasts. Sorry, Ben. And, you know, there's so much content out there. But I do think silence sometimes is immensely powerful. For me, it's my creative moment when your mind just wanders free. And I think it's immensely rejuvenating and empowering. You know, your thoughts can build and come up with something original. And so I would recommend a piece of silence in every day.
On that note, do you practice meditation or mindfulness at all, or is it just carving out periods of silence?
I practice nothing so stylish or woke, I'm really sorry to say. Mine is just sometimes I love just sitting quietly, looking out of the window or walking, and I don't plug in or play anything. I just let my mind wander. So, yeah, it's pretty ill-disciplined, but, you know, I think innovation is incredibly ill-disciplined in many forms. Sometimes the best ideas come from the biggest surprise of what you were thinking about. And sometimes I think you need to let yourself have that kind of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I really do believe that silence, periods, doing nothing at all are really critical leadership skills and moments, but they can be so hard to give ourselves permission to engage in, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, when we were younger, there were lots of periods of boredom. You know, we didn't have 100 channels and iPods and cell phones, mobiles. You know, our father put the television on and switched it off when he wanted to, and that was it. So it's easier for me to remember that time.
Yeah, and Dad had to get up and walk over to the TV set to turn it off, right? one of the four channels.
Yes, exactly. The terrible things I watched because it was all that was on.
Yeah, absolutely. Edwina, final one, where can people find out more about you, about the female lead, and how can they get in touch if they want to?
Well, you know, the female lead is open to everyone. There's thefemalelead.com. I am Edwina at thefemalelead.com. And if they are at school, they can go to the female lead societies and they will find all the materials that are free to schools. Films, books, everything. So, yeah, everyone is welcome. And, you know, I would love to hear people's ideas. You know, people sometimes write blogs for us or share content, and we're always happy to hear from them.
That's incredible. Edwina, thank you so much for your time coming on the show today. There's so much food for thought in what you shared. And I must say, kind of just the 35 minutes or so that we've been chatting and recording, I feel massively energized and inspired, which I think is a sign of a great leader. So thank you very much indeed.
That's very kind. Thank you, Ben. It's been an absolute pleasure.
There you have it, folks. My interview with Edwina Dunn, founder of The Female Lead. I really hope you found that episode as inspiring, enjoyable, and interesting as I did, and that it provides help and guidance for you on your own leadership journey. And remember, if you are ever feeling as though you are struggling to keep your head above water and stay focused in the fast-paced, complex, ever-changing world within which we all find ourselves these days, then do please check out the link to my brand new Personal Leadership Mastery course, which is designed to be the antidote to the VUCA world that we find ourselves working in, if you're familiar with that acronym. Do also make sure you take advantage of that exclusive 30% discount card that I've provided you with. And finally, if you're enjoying the show, then please do rate, review and subscribe via iTunes, as it means a huge amount to me. That's it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Take care, and I'll see you again very soon.